This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On Air.
Kia ora and welcome to the Digital Guardian podcast, where we have conversations about keeping our tamariki and young people safer online. I'm Sean Lyons from NetSafe, and in this series, I'll be joined by experts, professionals and academics to talk about navigating digital safety and well-being and how to support your child to be safer online with confidence and connection. If you're a parent or caregiver, there's a moment many of us quietly fear. The moment your child says, "So this thing happened online." And in that moment, your pulse quickens, your stomach drops and your heart races because you fear the worst and you want to fix it, protect them, make it disappear. In this episode, we're here to talk about what actually helps when something goes wrong online and what we should be focused on if a young person in our care discloses something about their online experience. I'm joined by Linda Bowden, a senior occupational therapist and mental health clinician with over 15 years' experience in child, adolescent and whānau well-being, and currently a manager at Te Aho, a national suicide prevention and postvention organisation. We're joined by Lucy Thomas, co-founder and CEO of Project Rocket, Australia's youth-driven movement against bullying, hate and prejudice. And Carla Sanders also joins us, a NetSafe team member and former CEO and founder of Sticks and Stones, a youth-led bullying prevention organisation here in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Let's get into it. I want to start where most parents start. That's the moment of, oh no, not my kid, mixed in with a healthy dose of, I have no idea what to do with this. These topics feel genuinely frightening for adults, often before anything has ever actually happened. So I want to start with you, Lucy, if I can. From your work with young people, what do adults worry about that young people aren't actually worried about?
Oh, this is a cracking opener, and certainly something that we hear a lot about, both in terms of parent concerns, but also, I guess, the gap between what young people feel they should be learning and focusing on and what schools, who ultimately serve parents, are teaching them when it comes to online safety education. So a couple of years ago, Project Rocket was really trying to understand this question about what are the top issues that matter to young people and how do they differ from the priorities that parents are grappling with. We did some research actually with the Young and Resilient Centre at Western Sydney University and a whole cohort of young people. We asked them, what do you learn in school when it comes to online safety education? And they told us about, you know, the kind of education they're receiving. It wouldn't surprise you. It covers things like extreme cyberbullying, exposure to unsafe strangers online, scams, you know, really kind of a lot of kind of malicious and really extreme behavior. But when we asked them what they're actually struggling with online, their answers were much more everyday. A lot of them talked about the everyday peer relationships, wanting to learn more about how to communicate and respect and maintain boundaries, consent, you know, lots of navigating change in friendships and relationships. And so what we came to see was that young people's experiences on the ground and what they're really dealing with are quite difficult. And probably the intersection was around cyberbullying. So that is a concern that impacts both parents and teens. I think that's a really important starting point. Although fundamentally their perceptions around the issue and how we could better address it, they really do differ. So yeah, certainly a bridge that we need to make between these two very, very important and special groups.
I know for a long time we've seen research that talks about parent worries, and you know, you hit the nail on the head. Pornography and predation, right? Those. Why do you think those topics are so sticky in those surveys if it doesn't reflect what's going on for young people?
I think if you're a parent in 2025, you're watching your child seemingly absorbed in some app or platform, they're holding the device in their hand, yet you don't have a clear line of sight into the content they're accessing or how it's affecting them emotionally and personally. That leaves you with a lot of unknown. And I think we tend to project our fears into the unknown, not just parents, but all of us. I think those fears are sometimes kind of amplified and exploited by popular mainstream media narratives about young people. It's a great way to achieve engagement is by drawing on people's fears. So I think that, you know, it's really unfortunate that parents, you know, who are already kind of vulnerable to the concerns and for great reason, they should be attuned to the concerns, actually end up having those concerns dialed up where it isn't always necessary. And even when it's necessary, it isn't necessarily helpful. So Yeah, I think there's certainly a lot around the kind of lack of connection and understanding of young people's digital lives. If we can build that kind of trust, but also the communication and understanding of the complex experiences they have, the positive, the bad, the random, the weird, all of these things side by side, I think we can start having much more nuanced conversations that aren't all driven by fear.
Thank you. So look, going on from that, Carla, spent a lot of time working alongside Rangatahi. What do you think the assumptions are that parents make early on that send those conversations, those situations, in fact, down the wrong track?
I think one of the key misunderstandings or assumptions that are made are that because young people often navigate technology with confidence in terms of the technical aspects of it, that they also have the understanding of all of the components of help seeking or what to do when things go wrong or how to navigate that in ways that would mitigate any risk. And unfortunately, we know teenage brains are still very much under construction. And so that makes it really difficult to make the right choice all the time. And I think that that misunderstanding between their confidence to navigate the way the tech works, as well as to navigate what it means for them and their friendships, their relationships, their self-image, mean that we sometimes mistake that confidence for confidence right across everything, should anything go wrong as well.
There are all sorts of other kind of safety aspects that parents take responsibility for that they probably don't make those same assumptions. People often talk about road safety and water safety, and they're not great analogues when we talk about online safety. But there is an element of that. We don't make those assumptions. Why do you think online we're prepared to do that?
I think that it's the one area that there is an enormous amount of parental judgment. And this is the time when nobody's really asking me when I'm feeding my children for breakfast, lunch and dinner. Nobody's asking me if they've learned how to swim, and nobody's asking me what time they go to bed. But they absolutely are asking me the age they got their first phone. They're asking me whether I use home filtering internet. And that judgment leads to some really quite knee-jerk reactions from parents who start to assume that they are lagging behind, that they are the ones putting their children at risk. I think the conversation needs to shift because we've got a whole lot of parents who are new to this as well. They're not entirely sure what the right answer is. We are making blanket statements that about one size fits all restrictions, filtering, settings, bans that are going to work for every child. And we know that they just don't. For my son, gaming was a really special place for him to build his confidence and to build his friendships. He struggled face-to-face with his peers, and it became somewhere where he could kind of flex his confidence, develop some relationships and kind of thrive in that environment. And that led to him developing his confidence in real world too. So I was, Googling things, I was chatting to other parents and finding out what might work for our family. But I'm absolutely confident that what works for our family is not going to work for everyone else. And I just wish we were more open and confident with one another about the fact that this is a judgment filled environment where there isn't a single right answer, and we're not providing parents with the opportunity to go to learn to swim school, and we're not providing them with opportunities to go into the learner's lane and do these things, and we're not giving them really beautiful graphics of the five a day and nutritious meal plans. So I think it's up to our sector to start doing those things to make it a little bit easier for parents too.
You talked about the conversations in there. And Linda, I want to ask you, can be quite a loaded thing when we talk about you just need to have a conversation. People interpret that in a very different way. Linda, you meet families in the middle of very big emotions. That's a kind of broad way to put it. At those points, what's happening for young people psychologically, emotionally, when they think they're in, which is often the case, I think, in these situations, when they think they're in trouble? And what can parents do to respond in a way that kind of settles things rather than escalates?
Well, there's like 1,000 questions in there, Sean. I think, what's happening for young people genuinely, I think, is probably a fair and reasonable amount of distress. And I think that also equally for young people, they are also afraid of the unknown at times too, particularly if they think they are in trouble. That sometimes for some young people, that is a world of unknown. They don't know what that means. Does that mean I'm kicked out of home? Does it mean my parents will disown me? Does it mean I'm not allowed to do a thing? Or does it mean the police are at my door? I don't know. So sometimes there is also an equal amount of young people are also experiencing unknown territory as well.
So what helps a parent's response calm things rather than escalate them?
I think in terms of our parent response or our parent space, it's hard to know, like Carla said, what is the potentially most ticker, most right thing to do in those situations, and possibly helpfully or unhelpfully, depending on how we react to these situations. I think the first thing to do is to breathe, which actually most of us, regardless of age, young people or adults, forget to do. We actually forget in any situation, crisis, danger, hurt, any of those situations, we do actually forget the need to breathe, to stop and breathe properly before we make any kind of decision about what we do next. And actually, we're all very good today, particularly in 2025, at going like out straight away, take a big breath and vomit something out. And actually, all of us, young people, again, all ages, we're just very quick on our feet, on the fly, in a very now living world of intense quickness. And actually, in terms of being calm, we need to control ourselves. We need to control our breathing and our own reactions. And in order to do that, we need oxygen to the brain. What is the best thing to do? And that can be really hard. I think a lot of parents naturally react to what they think is happening. And for many people, that's a jump in the pool and save your child. That's a jump in front of the car if you could. That's a jump in front of the phone and take it away and throw it against the wall. In some situations, you probably need to stay calm and breathe and let the child observe your calmness before they give you any more information. It's much easier to say, oh yes, just be calm, guys, than it is to do. But our experience tells us that when young people are in a situation and they're looking for help, they are very clever at sussing how we are responding. And genuinely, most kids don't run through a door if it looks like everyone's screaming. They're not coming to you. They're going to turn around and go, oh, no, that's not a good idea. I'm going to back out of that. I'm going to backpedal from whatever I said. I'm going to water it down. I'm going to take it all back and I'm going to miss out a whole lot of information. We do know that disclosure is hard for young people. And if they are sensing that there is fear, that there is judgment, that there is punishment, they're going to backtrack about what they say. And you might not be getting the whole truth from that young person's perspective anyway, because they're worried about what that means. And also, they're testing whether you're still that safe person. You know, is this something I can go through with? So I think the most helpful thing, again, very easy to say, harder to do, but is actually let them know that you are calm and reassure them that you are calm, even if you are not and you are squirming on the inside and screaming in your head. Pretend, fake it till you make it, because they need to know that whatever they say next, they can say it.
Yeah, I really want to echo that, Linda, because I think the other thing we'll often do is kind of leap straight to solution mode. And when we're leaping straight to solution mode, we miss the opportunity to ask the questions that are really key. And I always come back to, you know, the best question we can ask is like, what do you need from me right now? And that might be really hard to hear as a parent, because it might be, I just want you to listen. And then that's your role. And sometimes when we go straight to solution or fix it mode, we can often disregard the really important and valid feelings of our young people about them wanting to kind of talk it through and work out what's going to work for them, rather than asking us to jump in into the pool in front of the car without running it past them first.
Situations you described, that the responses though, that they're real sort of, you know, biological, they're really visceral. They're the things that we feel like we need to do in those physical kind of danger moments. And this obviously feels like a physical danger moment to many parents. I've been told to breathe many times by people, and it can be a difficult thing to hear.
Yes.
When you're not breathing. How do we practice that? How do we, and I'll take your point, the modeling that you do for young people in that process of deliberately taking a step back, considering what happens next, is absolutely vital for them in so many different ways. But how do we practice that as parents, apart from at the point where it's just like, and we feel like we're in control?
I think having key go-to lines, finding your way, your vibe that you communicate with your young person is the thing. You don't want anything super rehearsed, super practiced, super on stage, but you do need to find a way that tells your young person that you're still here and you're ready for that conversation. Like I said, even if you're not on the inside, I think like Carla said, you know, offering a space to listen is really important. And actually, when young people come to you, the first thing I think we all need to do, and I don't mean this in a judging way, but young people tell us all the time, is maybe also adults could put their phones down too. So I think actually the first thing is letting them know that you are available for this conversation, because young persons generally don't pick the most opportune time when all parents are just sitting down with a cup of tea and their feet up. Generally, it's a vomit, I need to tell you this, and then they're waiting. What's the reaction? What are you going to do? And I think a lot of the time, people are under the pump, let's be real. Life is busy. Parents are octopus hands in the air, all the things at the same time, cooking dinner and probably driving the car and organising the other events and trying to have a conversation and saying, yes, I'm present, I'm here for you. But young people are very quick on a, no, you're not. You know, they're really clear about what they want from their people. And I think we need to be saying a good start is, I'm here for it. I'm here. And actually just finding your vibe, finding your voice of the way that you communicate with your young person, that tells them that. I was out recently with some friends who told me a beautiful story about their young person coming to them, asking them for a definition of a word that they didn't know what the word was, but they'd read the word. And the dad said, and rather than ask them where they read the word, I was very good. And I said, oh, it just means this, straight away. Just launched into, let's have the chat. And then sure enough, out came that this is what I was on, Dad, and this is where I saw it, and you know, and out all the other things came. But how different that could have been if he just went with the, where were you, what were you doing, how did you see that word, why would you want to know that? And so he talked how proud he was of himself in that moment to say, oh, it just means this, casually. He said, I was absolutely screaming in my head about why she wanted to know that word. But again, it's a good move, right? Just saying, I'm here for it. Let's go. Even if you're not, because the minute they pick up that you're not, then you're not making them feel heard and validated. And that's the end of that line, really. And there's no more lines back in until they're ready.
You paint an amazing picture of a busy parent. I'm trying to
conjure. Maybe that's just my life. I don't know. Is anyone else's the same?
Talked about the fear to some extent and the perception around these things. I want to talk about what it looks like, what it actually looks like. So for young people, What is actually happening online? So stay away from the headlines. Let's talk about what's really going on for them. Lucy, first of all, you see a lot of peer culture up close from the work that you do. Are there patterns that you notice around how harm kicks off, how it spreads, the way it spreads, where it spreads? Are there patterns that you're seeing now that maybe you didn't see 20 years ago?
Definitely, Sean. I think the part that's really crystallized for me, particularly recently, is around the complexities of young people's experiences and how the good and the bad tend to exist side by side. As adults, we focus on young people's lives online and we think, oh, we want to protect them from the harms, but we don't want them to miss out from the benefits. But what I really see on the ground is that it's very common for a young person to be simultaneously navigating the pressures to be perfect online or to have lots of followers or to feel socially excluded from, you know, the group message thread or whatever, or to be encountering bullying or racism, but simultaneously online will be their space where they have community and support and, you know, their go-to representation where they see themselves and they might not see that anywhere else. So the challenge is that when we try and strip out all of the bad and protect them from that, we inadvertently strip out all of the good as well. So I guess for what I see, you know, in the young people that we work with a cohort of 50 young people aged 12 to 20 who are called the Project Rocket National Youth Collective. And so they're always telling us about this one fundamental thing that adults don't get. And that's that, you know, they expect risk online. They're teens. They expect risk in life. And that to some extent, this is going to make so many parents listening cringe, but a healthy degree of risk taking and testing of limits is inevitable. It's part of being a teen. But of course, what we imagine as adults is that that's going to result in the most extreme harm. And so for them, they're navigating so many issues without us because we expect the worst. And I think I think young people are telling us that they do really crave that custodianship, trusted adults in their lives. You know, they, as Carla acknowledged, they might be the experts in technology, but they certainly, don't have the whole benefit of life experience behind them. So they're craving that support, but they just want kind of the whole nature of their online experience, warts and all, to be held and understood. So, yeah, I guess for us with the National Youth Collective, we're hearing about experiences ranging from people who've been terribly bullied in school and had schools respond atrociously and actually make the harm even worse, have gone online and they found solace in gaming platforms and communities there. We hear from young people who have actually worked out how to shape their own algorithms so they're literate about the different ways that they can make sure that they're served content that affirms and validates their identities. We, of course, hear young people who really struggle switching off. And so that's a really difficult thing as well. For many of them, they're not using the time management tools that are available on their device. Instead, they're deleting whole apps for weeks at a time and then reconnecting. And so they've got these kind of, you know, their own personalized ways of using these things. So I'd say it's just incredibly diverse. But what I am noticing is that, you know, the young people who have rich and fulfilling lives and connections to family and community, IRL, are so much less susceptible to the harmful impacts. They're absolutely exposed to the risks, but whether or not they eventuate tends to depend on the supports that young people have around them offline and online as well. So, yeah, I think there's a lot that we can be doing to protect young people beyond nannying them. And it's about setting them up, you know, like we all needed growing up with, you know, the foundations and support and trusted adult and all of these kind of core supports that maybe we've started to take for granted, given that there are technical solutions that allow us to surveil young people at all hours. So, yeah, I think it's a much more hopeful perspective than you might imagine working directly with young people.
That idea that the blunt weapon, the get out of that space or stop using that device in the New Zealand school environment where you've spent a fair bit of time working, what are the early signs, do you think, of the kind of the harm beginning?
I think they mirror a lot of the time some of the things that you'll notice when there's tricky situations in the real world, right? You'll notice that there might be some behaviour changes or dynamic changes within friend groups. Often we've got this idea of online and offline being completely separate universes, right? But it's just not the case. And for young people, a conversation might begin in person and then continue in one platform and then finish in another. So that seamless nature of the interaction between the online and offline is a really key part here, because you're looking for signs that you might notice offline that indicate that there might be some challenges online. So they're really important. The other thing that I think is really interesting here is that young people will often confide in a friend first. So this is where you've got this amazing opportunity as an adult, whether that's a parent or someone else in a child's life, to talk about how they can support friends and like what does support look like in ways that you're not taking on a burden that you're not equipped to manage, you know, the same way we would for adults. So it's about having that chat to your kids about, oh, you know, I was hearing my poor son, he's 14, so he has a lot of these conversations. It's like, oh my gosh, I was helping this person today and this is what was going on for them, and what would you do if that happened to you? And he's just like, Mom. But it's that, what if that was your mate though? Like, how do you think you could help them? And then that becomes a really rich and important conversation. So the signs and answer your question in a super long way, Sean, they play out online and offline if harm's occurring. They're not obvious. They're really nuanced for each individual young person, the same as they are for an adult. It's not as simple as they might look anxious or worried if they get a notification on their phone. I wish it was as simple as that, but it's really not. And so it's about just noticing that you might see some changes in behaviour in a range of different ways, and also beginning some conversations, you know, when things might not seem like they're wrong, so that you can prepare that if things do become at a crisis point where it's much harder to have those conversations. But yeah, Sean, I wish I had a checklist, which is if you notice these five things your child is experiencing online harm, I'd be pretty stoked about it. I'd be popular at my kid's school for sure. But that just simply doesn't exist. And I think that regular conversations, my son loves it when I sit down and watch whatever he's gaming and be like, tell me what's happening with that guy, what's that one doing, show me that. He's, oh god, right, so this is this, and this is how this works. But it's that whole sense of I am genuinely interested in how he engages in his online time. He sends me some really cool memes, and you know, he's got videos that he wants to share, and I do the same back to him. It's showing him that I genuinely want to know what's happening in his online spaces, but I'm not going to snoop in and find out exactly what they are. I'm hoping he might share some of that with me, and then when things aren't going quite so well, we might have a peripheral side conversation that might open the door for a different conversation later.
Linda, can you talk to us about what that kind of transition for young people looks like from that, the kind of the state that they're in when things first go wrong, to the kind of I'm going to have to talk to mum and dad, to oh my goodness, I'm having this conversation. Is that a kind of steady process the whole way through, or does the landscape look quite different for young people at each of those stages?
I think it's a complex space, and it's not a this is the same trajectory for every child. I think it's different for every child. I think it's different for every family. And I think it's different again, depending, like Carla just beautifully outlined, depending on what the setup of natural communication is in your family. So obviously my sharp end of the situation is often it can be a really scary time for young people. They're very scared and panicked and worried just as much as the adults are. And for some young people, again, depending on the situation they find themselves in, it might be a bit more of a crisis situation. It might have escalated quite quickly, and now they're at the point of, oh my gosh, I think I have to tell my parent. And sometimes young people tell us, I don't know which one's worse. You know, like, what does that say for young people? If I don't know which one, what to do, which situation is worse, telling my parent or telling someone else that I don't know that might be able to help me. So in some cases, we've got some young people who might be engaging, for example, here in Aotearoa with NetSafe, and that might be a safer option for them. For whatever reason, they're more worried about what might mum and dad say if I tell them. And so I think, well, sometimes there'll be, you know, we have conversations with young people who say, I'm thinking about telling my parents about this thing, but I don't know if I should. And so they're trying to find out whether they should or could tell them. I think I wish the trajectory was pretty simple. It's not. I think sometimes kids are in situations where it might be the beginning phase of something. They're not sure if that's what it is. And so then they're not sure if they should check out with an adult. Is this what's happening? And sometimes I think there is also a group of young kids who are worried that they might be implicated as a perpetrator. And so they are also working out, do I say this and do I tell someone and then am I in trouble, or what happens if I tell? And I mean this, there are also a set of young people who are worried, who have literally read whatever they've got on screen as a fact, you know, you can't tell an adult, and so they won't. So they are genuinely believing what they are seeing, and so they're actually genuinely worried about the safety of their family or other people, depending on what's happening online, and therefore that implicates how a young person is feeling. So sometimes we see young people who are genuinely scared and fearful of the outcome, fearful of the repercussion, and also fearful for the safety of themselves and their family, which seems justified and legit in their world. You know, that makes sense. And I think that's the other thing to remember, is that when it goes wrong, young people are experiencing all the things that we all did when we did things that probably weren't quite right either. And that hasn't changed, eh? Our feelings of what we feel in the moment, in human, in person, is still real. Kids still feel embarrassed and shamed and worried, just like we did when we took the keys without asking. That hasn't changed, even though it's online. It might be a quicker scale, and in some cases it could be very serious harm and threats, you know, in terms of serious harm for them and serious safety concerns, but their feelings are still the same. They're still experiencing the same worries that we all were, you know, with different experiences previous and in life's past, but still the same depth and the same worry and the same legitimate fears and emotions are occurring for young people too.
I think for young people, there are also a whole range of unwritten codes and social dynamics as to how you navigate something happening in your peer circle, in your year level. And, you know, parents tend to worry about what's happening to their child, but actually our child has a role to play in what's happening to the people around you as well. And from a completely self-centered perspective, you'd want to raise your child to help others so that they get help in return. But also, it's these individual behaviours that shape a collective culture. And I was thinking about this recently. I actually heard some media reporting around a case of image-based abuse in a major school here in Australia. And the narrative was around some boys who had nudified images of their female classmates. But what stood out to me about the story, it was one of the rare occurrences where the whole thing was uncovered, not by the female students, but by one of the boys who'd received the photo, and he actually came forward and reported it very early on. And as a result, the photos, you know, weren't as widely circulated as they could have been. We don't hear those stories, and so they're not normalised and they're not heroed. But I was really interested in, I'd love to hear that young man's story. What were the experiences? What was the parenting that shaped that decision-making? I'm sure that he'd be facing risk of fallout from his peers or worry that he'd be in trouble or blamed or, you know, all of this kind of stuff, but ultimately made that decision to do what he believed is right. And I think these are the kinds of decisions that young people are grappling with every day around that test their loyalties, right? You know, do I go out on a limb and face being ostracized? These are the kinds of challenges that we all faced in adolescence, but now we're just seeing them play out with, you know, technologies and devices that adults largely don't understand. So, yeah, I also think we don't do a great job in celebrating the young people that are creating these really dynamic and positive online spaces for themselves, but for peers as well. And I think as adults, we have a role to play in encouraging them towards those, yeah, really healthy behaviours when they do see things that aren't okay, even if it's not happening to them.
And having some of those conversations like before the proverbial hits the fan, right? You know, it's really hard when you're in crisis mode and, you know, there's a picture of something out there that you never thought you were going to have to navigate. And then in that moment, you're not having the ability to really think through and be reflective of, you know, like, what's the right conversation to have and what are the choices that are available here and what might some of the different outcomes be. But we do have that option to have those conversations before any of the harm occurs. And there's some really wonderful opportunities to take the fear-mongering headline and unpack it, you know, with your kids and to be talking about, gosh, that sounds like really scary. You know, what would you want me to do if I'd found out something like that? Or what are some of the things that we could do here? And, you know, what'd stop you reckon? Like, if that was me, this, I might be worried that other people might think I'm a narc, or, you know, that they might think that, you know, it's cool to go along with it, you know, and start to break that down. But we do have the opportunity to rehearse this and to shape the options so that we're more likely to consider those things when we are in crisis. Now, that's not going to mean it's perfect. We're humans, right? But if we've got the opportunity to talk things through, I mean, one of the conversations I've had in our family is like, dude, your dick could be on a billboard and we'd still love you, because you're going to make mistakes. That is going to be things that are going to be embarrassing and humiliating. But at the end of the day, there is nothing that could happen. There's nothing online that you could do, show, or have someone share that's going to mean we're not here for you. And you know, yes, it's going to be awkward and embarrassing and all of those things. But, you know, that's a really uncomfortable conversation to have as a parent. But it's also one that I do hope that if the proverbial hits the fan, that we've got some openness, which is, okay, yeah, you know how we talked about that? It's not quite that bad, but it's this. And how are we going to manage it?
That's lovely. A lot of what we're talking about here, it's groundwork, right? It's we're talking about the things that families do before the billboard, before the proverbial starts rotating at escape velocity. So I want to ask you some questions around that. Lucy, your Project Rocket, all about agency and empowerment of young people, right? So how can parents foster that sense of agency at home, especially when that, you know, we talked about that visceral reaction before, is to restrict, lock things down, prohibit. What is it parents can do in that space?
I think parents have a lot more tools in their kit than they might imagine. You know, that you anticipate this is a conversation about the technicalities of platforms and apps and devices that young people are using. Actually, you know, we work with hundreds of thousands of teens each year, and the conversations that we're mostly having aren't about buttons to click or safety features to activate or how to lock down your account. They're actually about values. So many of these conversations, we talk about the fact that you can't expect young people to stand up if you don't know what they stand for. That's very relevant in the bullying space. But we also know that if young people have a clear compass, a values-based compass through which they lead their online interactions, they're a lot better set up for an ever-changing variable environment where the buttons to click and the strategies are going to change anyway. So I think what we tend to look for as adults is something quite concrete, and it's like, what's the information I need to give them? When actually our focus is much more on what are the capabilities that we need to build, and those capabilities range from self-awareness, what are my values? When I feel ick online, when someone reaches out to me and I don't know them and something feels off, how do I notice that feeling and how do I trust it? When do I notice that I feel my values are compromised? Right through to how, if something's giving me a sense something's off, how do I identify that as actual critical thinking, and how do I start to sharpen and use that tool? You know, some of these kind of literacies and capabilities that young people really need. So how do I have difficult conversations? I'll tell you what, when it comes to cyberbullying, so many of the harms and episodes we see are actually a result of young people not having had the space to adequately develop conflict resolution and navigate difficult environments and communicate with each other. So this is the work that starts much younger than the age at which a young person gains a social media account. It happens from day dot. And so I think it's really just understanding that more than ever, young people don't need strategies, they need capabilities. And we can all play a role in building those so that, you know, they can navigate these technologies not only in a safe way, but in a way that's empowered and actually set for change.
And when the menus change, that carries on through as well, right? If the button disappears, you can still do all those things. It doesn't rely on that level of knowledge and understanding. Linda, from a well-being point of view, are there practices, are there rhythms that help build resilience in young people in this space? Are there things that parents, families, broader families can do to support that resilience in young people? And is that important?
I think it is important. I think it's important for anyone. And I think that's the... there is this beautiful opportunity. I was thinking about what we were talking about before, about where are the opportunities for celebrating. And it has become a bit of a parenting competition almost, which is extreme in some ways, because why aren't we celebrating the awesomeness of parenting? Actually, on the whole, there are some really awesome young people out there doing amazing things online and being really great online with each other. And we're not saying, oh, well, high five you, parent. You can take annual leave for the rest of the year. You know, where's the celebration of actually building a community of these already amazing young people who are doing really well, and how can we make that the more common thing rather than the conversation automatically starts with everything everyone's got wrong or done wrong or is wrong. And actually, we haven't really built this way of, if we were building young people from the start to know that actually life is full of a turbulent journey where we will make decisions and we will make mistakes. And some of those can be some pretty harsh consequences depending on what you do. Some of them might be a bit sucky. Some of them might feel different. Some of them might be a we navigate this together. But actually, we need to teach young people, children, small children, that happens. That does happen. You might go to school and a bird might poo on you. That might happen. Doesn't mean you get to go home. Doesn't mean you turn around and walk away and the day is done, even if you want it to be. But, you know, there are times where I think there are opportunities in life that we have to teach young people about that are hard, and decision-making is hard and consequences can be harsher. But it doesn't mean that we don't teach them how to navigate it. It doesn't mean that we don't say, yes, you made a mistake and that's happened and we will get through this. You will get through it. It might not be how you intended. It might not be what either of us thought this was going to be, but we will get through this together. And I think that's the joining of meeting young people where they're at, meeting children where they're at, and teaching, creating environments is where we say, actually, this might happen. There, sometimes people will make mistakes. I think kind of earlier what Carla was coming in and saying about solutions, we have become a bit of a society that's pretty quick to say, these are the problems, let's fix it. You know, the Bob the Builder mopping it up situation has almost become a way. You know, there are some situations where I hear, even with parents when I'm doing family work, around it's not okay for them to fail and we will save them every time. And I think that's a difficult place to be in this current landscape of life if we're trying to say that they won't ever make a mistake and they might need some growth mindset about how to survive that, and that they can and they will, and that we want them to and we will do it with them, I think is a key space to be thinking about. How do we create environments for young people? Because actually sometimes they need that in person too. Whereas at the moment, it's been, you know, very global pandemic, everything is hard, everything is difficult. Now there's online, that just came out of nowhere all of a sudden, as if we haven't been battling this beast for a while and thinking about what do we know, how do we do this? We are generally good humans. How do we navigate this?
And just because our childhoods didn't involve the kind of internet and day-to-day that many of our children are experiencing, that doesn't mean we have to hark back to this nostalgia of it would be so good if they were outside with hoops and sticks. It's a different time, and I think that it's a really important that we can navigate this in a way that we don't think that they are suffering because there is different ways to interact and engage. Our childhoods were different from our parents, whose were different from their parents as well. And I think the moment that we start to use nostalgia as something to be utilised in order to put boundaries or restrictions in place to hark back to a safer and better time, we miss the opportunity to work alongside our young people.
Well, you're implying my kids used to really love Hoop and Stick Tuesday.
I know, I'm like, Carla, when did you grow up? In like 1902? You're doing really well, I have to say.
Thanks.
So we've talked about rehearsing or preparing for these conversations, but if your child walked in tonight and said, you know, something's gone wrong online, what's the most important thing a parent should remember to help that conversation along? Linda, what does a trauma-aware first response sound like?
I think probably the easiest thing to think about if I was in that situation, I think the key thing is, like I said, be calm, be curious, and be compassionate. And I think if parents can start with those kind of the triple C's of connection, in my view, then I think you're onto a good thing. You know, helping young people know that you're here to listen without judgment, and to invite them to help you understand what's happening or what's happened is the first key thing. And then, you know, hopefully they'll start to share, these are the facts from their point of view, or this is what's happened, or you're gathering info about the events. But essentially, calm, curious, and with compassion, then they know, okay, this looks like a somewhat trustworthy thing for me to get into.
Carla, for you, you've obviously worked a lot directly with young people experiencing bullying and harassment. What have you seen or heard that parents do that can help de-escalate the situation rather than escalate it?
Totally. I'm feeling like I've got to try and do something as cool as Linda sees, and I'm not sure I can do it. But I think, like, for me, the big one is, like, recognise, don't minimise. For us, we constantly hear young people being told things like, oh, it's not even a big deal, just, like, switch it off, you know, there are starving children in the world, or this could be so much worse, like, why is this even a big deal? And when we minimise that, it means that we're less likely to get an approach next time. I'll never forget the best piece of advice that I got, which is, if we're not open to the small things, to listening to my 10-year-old tell me all of the details about K-pop demon hunters and all of the food that they eat and how important it is, then the door's not open for the big issues. And so making sure we don't minimise things. If it's a big deal for them, it's a big deal for you. It's hurting them, it's worrying them. So you need to affirm that and be able to recognise it without making them feel like it's not a big deal, because in their lives it is. And be open to, you know, to listen to those small things, working out how Minecraft works, you know, getting to understand all of those many different blocks and how important and exciting their treasure chest is, means that they're going to be much more likely to come to you when something is a bit ick, as Lucy said earlier, or is sort of made that gut reaction. And they're like, oh, you know, mum or dad will probably care about this because, you know, they care about the other stuff that I'm doing too.
Lucy, to you, we've spoken lots of times about how important young people are in the lives of other young people in these situations, and how often they're the port of call, they're the primary support when young people experience this. Do you think there are things that families can learn? Adults often don't see that side of what's happening. Are there things that families can learn from how young people step up to support each other in these situations?
Look, I certainly do. And I was just trying to place myself in the shoes of someone then who's, you know, a parent who's having that experience of a young person coming forward and sharing this thing that's harmed them. And that to me feels like one of those significant parenting moments where the thing that you've worried about has eventuated and your child is coming forward to tell you about it. But I think I'd also view that, to flip it just slightly, as one of those great parenting moments where your child has trusted you to come forward to talk to you about something that they're really worried about, and believes that you are someone who can help them. And to me, while it's a horrible scenario that reveals that kind of that trust and rapport, it's important that we don't lose sight of how important that line is, and that in that moment, you know, that connection can be extinguished just as quickly as it, much quicker than actually it was built. And so, you know, I think one of the things that young people do really well is prioritize the connection at all costs. And that's something that we can learn from as adults. So, you know, it is about that curiosity that, you know, the others have kind of spoken about, that we can't always involve young people in the solutions to the problems that they're facing. Sometimes we do need to just jump in and take action when there are extreme risks or extremes going on. But I do believe it's always possible to ask, what does support look like for you? Are you looking for solutions or are you looking for listening? You know, some of these questions just make such a huge difference when what you're really looking for is to be seen and held by the adult that you love, and when you're scared and you don't know what to do. And so, yeah, I think we can take that a little bit, that playbook a little bit from young people and how they tend to support each other. Where they struggle is to take that trust and listening and turn it into action a lot of the time. And so that's something to acknowledge as well. But I think as adults, often they're usually coming to you because they've tried speaking to their peers and they are now needing that support. Even if they tell you not to tell anyone, they probably know on some level that you will need to. And so, yeah, I think it's just about how we maintain that. First of all, we recognize that this is a real positive that they're coming to you, and that we can try and maintain that strengths focus kind of moving through what is probably going to be a difficult situation ahead.
Thank you to our guests today, Lucy, Linda and Carla. If there's one key message to take away, it's this: connection matters more than control. When young people tell us something has gone wrong online, that moment is fragile, but it's also powerful. Remember, you don't have to have all the answers. The most important thing is to stay calm, stay curious, and perhaps most important of all, stay compassionate. And if you're looking for practical tools, conversation starters, and guidance for navigating these moments, you can explore the NetSafe Digital Guardian Guide, a free resource designed to support whānau at every stage of their child's digital journey. So jump online and head to digitalguardian.guide. Thanks for listening and for showing up for your young people. NetSafe has supported people across New Zealand to have safe and positive online experiences for over 25 years. You can contact our helpline for free, confidential advice and support on any online issue you or your whānau may be experiencing. Call 0508 638 723, text NetSafe to 4282, email help@netsafe.org.nz, or contact us via our website, netsafe.org.nz.
This podcast was produced by ORFM Dunedin with support from New Zealand On the Air.